At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi film fans, how are you? I hope this finds you well and that you have had a wonderful weekend. What did you watch? Did you watch anything? There is an abundance of things to dive into to maybe help you escape from everyday life or just transport you off to somewhere new and different. And it's that time of year as well where the award season is kind of, you know, getting towards that moment of revelation of who's going to pick up what, and then also already kind of tips for films that we should be looking out for this year. So it never really stops, to be honest, which is great for us, which means we've got constant conversations. Couple of things just off the back of the BAFTA nominations this week. Really, really chuffed that Saoirse got a nomination for leading actress for The Outrun. If you are a regular listener to this show, you'll know how much we love that film and how much that performance just really connected with me, and so I'm so glad to see that she got nominated for that. And we're really proud about the number of people that we've had on the podcast that have been nominated, which is just kind of great to see. And so if you check out our socials, we're going to be kind of highlighting just some of the conversations that we've had on the show with those that are in the running for, be it Oscars, BAFTAs, Golden Globes, they've already happened, so not this year's, SAG Awards, all those kind of things as well. And also want to send our best wishes to everybody out in LA who's been affected by the fires. There are so many creatives who are affected and have lost their livelihood. I was chatting to someone just this week about a composer friend of theirs whose all his instruments have gone. So we send our love and best wishes to everybody out there who's been affected by the fires. One of the people that I was really surprised wasn't nominated in BAFTAs was James Mangold. I always find it interesting when the film picks up, you know, an array of nominations from the performances to lots of the craftspeople. Even the film gets a nomination, but for some reason, director doesn't get the recognition, considering he's the kind of captain of the ship. It happened with Scorsese a few years ago as well. It's so bonkers, it slightly blows my mind. But anyway, you can dive into our wonderful conversation with James Mangold talking about A Complete Unknown from last week, and the film is out in cinemas now. Our latest guests on soundtracking are Brady Corbett and Guy Pearce, respectively director and star, talking about awards, of the multi-award-winning film The Brutalist. In it, Adrian Brody plays a Hungarian-born Jewish architect who survives the Holocaust and emigrates to the US, where he struggles to achieve the American dream until a wealthy client changes his life. The cast also features knockout performances from Felicity Jones, Stacey Martin, Rafi Cassidy, Emma Laird, Alessandro Nivola, Joe Alwyn. And it is such a beautiful and wonderful commitment to the love and the craft of filmmaking. Brady's done an amazing job. You'll hear him talk about that as well in terms of the choices that he made, what he shot on, how he shot, limitations of budget and all that kind of thing. It's so fascinating to hear. And it equally is a commitment from an audience to go and sit through a 3.5-hour film. But I promise you, you will feel richer for the experience. Even the commitment that's made to the intermission in the middle, which is 15 minutes, but there is something on screen which will give you the opportunity to take a break, and however that is, even if it's just taking a breath. The Brutalist is scored by Daniel Blumberg, a phenomenal score, and we'll begin with his cue, Up the Hill.
Up the Hill. Hi, Edith. How are you?
Nice to see you.
How are you? All right.
Yeah, good. Thanks very much. Yeah, I'm great. How are you both?
Yeah.
All right.
Awesome.
Holding up. Just talking about how tired.
Hanging in there.
Yeah. What time zone am I on? What country am I in?
Yeah,
all that
exactly.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I know, we just keep seeing each other in different countries and sort of don't even say goodbye. We just to turn up in another country. And
no, but that's exactly right. That's exactly
like
right.
I lost you in that back room after the Critics Awards the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And then I sort of left and then...
Here we are in London.
We'll see you in London.
Yeah, well, it's kind of nice, actually.
Yeah.
It's like a lot less pomp and circumstance.
I was excited to talk to you today about the film. And then on top of that, you come out with the most amazing collection of BAFTA nominations today as well. So huge congratulations.
Thank you.
For it, you know, resonating again with an audience.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
Yeah.
It's so cool. And for my cinematographer and my production designer and stuff, it just totally rocks.
Well, just hearing you talk about the film, that kind of, you know, the collaboration and teamwork is something that you seem to kind of really relish and enjoy as part of a filmmaking process.
Oh, I mean, you better. It's a collaborative medium. I mean, you know, it just, you have to have an affection for human beings.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because you also have a very uncompromising view of the vision you want to make, but you bring the people to you who you know you can and want to collaborate with, who are only going to elevate the process, not try and shut down things. So it's collaborative, but at the same time, it's also got to be, you've got to have a clear sense of what you want.
I guess what it is that you need to have these pillars of the project that are the things that you just can and never will compromise on. But then everything in between, you have to be very nimble and you have to respond. You have to respond to the space and you have to respond to a performance. I really struggle with storyboarding because I feel like locked into this imaginary concept.
I would agree. I would imagine storyboarding is just like, why does it even exist?
Well, you become a slave to it.
Yeah.
You're like, that doesn't look like the cartoon.
No, whose insecurity decided on storyboards? You know,
like, someone who's a really good drawer, who can do really good art, who's just trying to show off.
I know Denis Villeneuve and his team are like some of the only folks I know that use storyboards extremely well. Because in general, I think that if you're in a studio and you actually are controlling the light and you are like, then you need to respond to it less, I suppose, because you are creating it. But in general, it's just like, what if somebody does something that's more interesting in the rehearsal.
You go, but on my drawing it says you walk over there.
Exactly.
So. And the natural light might be different. The nature might have messed with something or reacted to something.
But you know, it's filmmaking, it's like free jazz, you know? It's like an organized chaos. It really is. And so there are sort of boundaries and there are rules that you have to adhere to. But then you also, you know, you need to give everyone a chance to do their solo. I mean, it's like, otherwise I think that it just sort of turns into nothing. The way I imagine a film is so much smaller than what the films end up being. And that's because of even the environments literally in my mind's eye are smaller than when I get, I'm like, oh, we have so much space. We have so much vastness. And that's something that just comes with the reality. It's not, reality is sometimes disappointing, but rarely, usually it's better than what you thought it might be.
Going back to what you said about the pillars that you have, you know, in terms of, and then the kind of freedom within those, what, for you, the Brutalist, I mean, it's the most extraordinary experience to watch it and what you get from it as a film fan. It's the most classic piece of cinema I've seen in so long, like nothing I've ever seen for a very long time. But for you, what were the pillars, Brady, in terms of the things that you know, that were so important to you with regards to this film?
It was important. It's always important, you know, for me personally, to shoot films on celluloid. And you know, I'm not at all dogmatic, and there are many filmmakers I know that, you know, that won't touch the stuff. Like they only want to work, with a digital workflow, and they've got good reasons for that. But for me, it's my best tool for accessing the period, especially. And because I'm mostly making historical movies, I find that it just immediately takes me there as a viewer in a way that, you know, unfortunately, historical movies that are shot digitally, something that you can't quite put your finger on frequently feels a little strange to me. Now, of course, there are the great exceptions. And I mean, like what Jonathan Glazer did with The Zone of Interest and the way that John thinks, like that is a movie that could only exist on that format and under the skin too. But, you know, I think that I feel like everyone's always asking me, you know, to justify why I want to shoot the movie on film, when I feel like it should be the other way around. It's like, well, why do you want me to shoot it on a digital format? I don't really get it the real way.
Because it's called a film.
because it's called a film. Exactly. And also, if we can afford to do it, I mean, my first film, my wife's last film, I mean, both of her last films were all shot on celluloid. And my first movie was, I think, under $3 million. And so if we can do it, anyone can do it. But it is something you have to prioritize. And it is an expense. And so you have to decide what you're going to sacrifice and to be able to pay for it. But in my case, I usually just cut one day of shooting. And then it pays for itself.
Guy, the performance in this is extraordinary, and the secrecy that's held within your performance, that slowly but gently, and you know, kind of has little cracks here and there until we're kind of exposed to the character sort of fully, both extremes almost in a way. You talked the other night when we had the luxury of having a chat about kind of how much was in the script and how rich the script was for you. But, you know, that's going back to what Brady was saying about there being pillars, but you still need the freedom as an actor to interpret and to bring your version of that to the table.
Sometimes, yes, you do. And the most exciting way for me to work, and I think the best way for me to work, and the most truthful way for me to work, is to purely respond to something I read that feels fully formed. I think that, yes, there are times when you have to interpret and you have to bring extra stuff and you have to build and you have to create and find elements, but usually because that's not there in the script.
Yeah.
When it's there in the script, I'm off and running. I mean, we had lovely chats along the way and we talked about the voice that I might use. And so there was no doubt some things that I did, and there was an interpretation mm-hmm. of what these guys wrote. But it really felt like I genuinely saw this person based on what I read. Mm-hmm. My imagination was fully sort of in sync. And mm-hmm. I'm sure it's probably different than perhaps what you might have imagined as the character. I don't really know, but I felt like I saw a fully formed person and just went, this is great because of all those complexities of the character that were in there.
And, yeah.
You know, these guys wrote a script about the complexities of people.
Yeah.
There's a number of themes in the story, and there's a love story, and there's all sorts of elements in this film which are wonderful, but they're interested in the three-dimensional nature of human beings, and they exist in the script. And often that's not there, and I'm having to go, I better sort of, not about find backstory, but I better find that third dimension. What's the character scared of? What are they? Where are their fears? Whereas all that was in here.
Yeah.
So it was a joy. It was such a joy.
Was there any music written into the script?
Well, there's descriptions of music. So the solo piano, there's a lot of notes about, there's a handful of source cues like buttons and bows and stuff that was scripted. But Daniel and I, you know, we started talking about it very early on in the process. It was maybe about 18 months or something after I'd written it, and it took many years then to get off the ground. And, you know, we had an approach and a methodology that we stuck pretty closely to. I mean, what's interesting for me is that, you know, actually for me, the performances in the film and the film's aesthetic and the film's design is very, very close to what I imagined. Mm-hmm. It's not always like that. Sometimes there's surprises. There's good ones. There's bad ones. There's surprises. But this film did go more or less according to plan, except for how long it took to get off the ground, which is, of course, not part of the plan. but you know, I think that the score, I think it's an extraordinary score. Yeah. Oh. And
I agree.
I think there's nothing quite like it. And it's 110 minutes of music because the film is so long. And it was made with a really measly budget. And, it's all live musicians, you know, it's not done with Spitfire or anything. So, you know, for all of my collaborators, they had to figure out with their very modest means, just like I had to figure out with my very modest means, how to deliver on the promise of the ambition of the film. You know, when they had the same amount of money you'd have to write like a jingle for an advert. And I really mean that.
Wow. Score is so many things, and I gave myself the luxury of just having the score in my ears all day today as I was walking about, and it's so transportative. It's so many things, and you know, you kind of have that first half with those three notes that represent themselves or start off so many of those cues and take you off. It's almost like the jumping off point and lots of different kind of melodies then. It's so clever because it makes you feel really safe when you're listening to it, but kind of like, where are we going almost in a way as well? What were the conversations, you know, that you had with Daniel about the kind of subtleties and the delicacies that are in there, but on also the kind of the big, you know, you have those big horns that come in at times.
Well, I think like the film itself, there's this sort of tension between, you know, classicism and modernity. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, there are aspects of the film that owe a debt to films of a bygone era and film scores of a bygone era.
Yeah.
But then there are also these very radical, very contemporary, you know, ways in which the score was built. I mean, it's predominantly all the percussion, for example, is prepared piano, you know, where we literally take nickels and dimes and screws and use the piano strings as a percussive instrument. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of very radical, very modern ways in which it was sort of built. And what's so cool, for example, I don't get to talk about this very often.
It's great.
So it's no, I know.
And I'm saying for me, Isabel, I love this score.
Please keep going.
The score is one of the best things I've ever done.
So, well, there's this kind of extraordinary thing that Daniel and I discussed early on about prepared piano, which is that, you know, if recorded properly, the inside of that sonic space is immense. But with such modest means, you get this sound that's even bigger than a timpani. So it's just this really versatile instrument. And we hired some of the greatest, you know, pianists on the planet to contribute, including John Tilbury, who, you know, if you've ever listened to Morton Feldman recordings or anything, it's usually John that was playing him. And he's in his late 80s, and, you know, his contribution is just, it was so exciting to be able to work with him and Evan Parker on saxophone. Like, it's
did you do that
crazy.
In England or in America?
It was all done in England. Yeah. The only thing that was done in the U.S. was Vince Clarke of Depeche Mode and Erasure collaborated with Daniel on the synth version of the score that's in the 1980s part in Venice. So I mean, honestly, the soundtrack was sort of its own production.
Yeah.
And you know, fortunately, folks noticed. And I'm particularly excited for, you know, Daniel's nomination today because he, you know, he's 31 years old or something. So it's kind of amazing.
And he just looks like he should be with a couple of, you know, mixing decks in a nightclub in London somewhere, doesn't he? Just so unassuming. He's created this incredibly classic score that is so moving. And I'm with you. I have a copy of it on my computer, so I'm listening to it all the time as well.
So great. I played Library on the radio the other day.
It's beautiful.
Right.
I mean,
right,
it's just a beautiful, it's really, well, the other thing about, this is the last thing I'll say about the piano.
No.
So something that I learned about, you know, I've never had piano in a score before. Mm-hmm. Scott Walker, we were always using a lot of double basses and you know, more traditional percussion. But piano, because of the reverb, it's very, very difficult to edit. So what that meant for Daniel was that for approximately, I don't know, maybe 16 minutes or something of solo piano, he had to record it for 2 weeks to actually get what ended up in the film, because it was impossible to slice into it. It would have been jarring if you sliced into that reverb. There was no way to really do it delicately. And so it had to be played, you know, mostly live. And so there are other aspects of the score, you know, which were built, but you know, there's so many live performances in the film that are preserved. I like Axel Dorner and his wife doing this incredible horn duo together during the sex scene in the film, and it's really cool because these two musicians are married and they're lovers in real life, and it was like play the film, play the theme as two lovers, and they did it. And it was like, it was like this crazy cobra dance, you know, where you're just like, it's just, and that is really like, that's what they played. It went straight into the movie, and that was that.
That's also testament to you, you know, going back to what you were saying about the script, that's testament to what people are reading or the scene, if you're giving them a scene as to what it's their, what they're scoring to, or the conversations that you're having, almost going back to those kind of like, you know, kind of benchmarks of what you want it to be, and they're reacting to that. They're emotionally connecting with a character, with a scene, with a situation. That's it's
well,
all kind
if,
of feeds
if
each
I
other.
Can just say that the, as well as the script being beautifully written, it was really inspiring. It really, I think, made everybody go, oh, not only do I want to be involved, but I really want to do my best work here.
Yeah.
So that was a real charged feeling that I got from it.
When you're talking about the piano bit as well, it's almost kind of, I'm a big believer in fate. And I think that almost kind of like when you know it's right, you know, kind of thing. And so almost kind of like the length of the reverb and the way that you've placed it in the film, it's like it was meant to be that way because it fits. It's the right time. It's the right.
I yearn for a more analog cinema, and you know, it's even there's notations and stuff in the screenplay about how the pianist at his bench, you know, you hear him turning the pages of his sheet music and all. There's all this stuff that generally there's all this life that people generally kind of, you know, that they scrub out.
Yeah.
And I understand why, of course, and it's not appropriate for absolutely everything, but it was so important to me that the music was a character, because otherwise, if it's just someone asleep at the synths or whatever, I'd rather just leave a performance alone.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't think, I think a great performance rarely needs to be aided by score. So this had to do something that expressed the interior life of these characters that, you know, both Guy's character and Adrian, Erzsébet, it's a different situation, but with Guy's role and Adrian's role, these are two characters that don't say what they mean. And so there's something very interesting, you know, Laszlo's inability to express himself verbally and the way that it comes out like a leak through his work and everything that Guy's character is hiding and is keeping so close to the vest, you know. For me, Guy's character is a wolf in wolf's clothing. He seems somehow like, you know, well, like he comes out the gate so brutal, so awful that he couldn't possibly be that awful. And
oh, could he?
Yeah, I mean the film is a 1950s melodrama, and you know, it's not, I love neorealist films. I love Mike Leigh, I love Ken Loach. There's so many, you know, those are movies I love, but those are not the movies that I make.
Yeah.
And this is a 1950s melodrama, and it required the performers, you know, to take a real leap of faith, because there's a certain sort of largesse about the style of performance in the 1950s. And I was so lucky to have, you know, partners that understood what that meant and exactly how to walk up to the line and not cross it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, you know, that it's a real, I don't know. I think that the performances in the film, I'm very proud of everyone. You know, Joe and Alessandro and Isaac. And I mean,
Stacey,
everyone is just doing such great work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do you want to write to music at all? Do you ever have music when you're writing, you know, in terms
of? Oh, yeah. I mean, I listen to music all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I like extremes, you know, like,
yeah.
I like, you know, I want to hear someone play their guitar until their fingers bleed, you know, or until, you know, play the sax until their lungs explode, or, you know, or quite the opposite,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like, I have an album, it's just silence. It's silence. It's just
like an Andy Warhol exhibition. No,
yeah, and it's kind of amazing.
I quite like that sound of like vinyl at the end, where it's just that.
Yeah,
it's so great.
That.
I mean, the thing is, technically, there are variations of silence mm-hmm. on the album, but it is silence. but as a filmmaker, you're constantly listening to room tone. And so you do spend a lot of time just listening to what's the right kind of silence for this scene.
Yeah.
And it evokes a real feeling, and it matters. It's, you know, it's what actually you can nestle a vocal performance inside of it. And if you choose the wrong kind of silence, it doesn't complement the performance, weirdly.
Guy, do you use music at all in terms of prep around characters or, you know?
I mean, I love music and I live for music, and it's a really important part of my life, and I love spending time in my studio and creating music, etc. I think when it comes to character, and that I need to put the music away.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily need to turn to music to help me find a character necessarily. Yeah. I will strangely, I go through periods of listening to different things at different times, and I do sometimes end up with a collection of things that I listen to during a shoot, not necessarily because I needed to, but just the timing of it means that they're the three CDs I have in the car, so I've got them on rotation as I'm driving home from set or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's an association that I'll then make, and I think what happens is there is a sort of like almost like tics that you kind of rely on a little bit, you know. I got back into listening to Jeff Buckley's Grace album, funnily enough, when we were shooting this. And I would listen to that on those drives from where we were staying and where we were shooting.
Yeah.
And so that sort of became it wasn't like I needed it to get into character, but it just, yeah, I don't know. Just,
I can see it's a longing he has.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just an incredible album anyway.
Yeah, totally.
So yeah.
It's not often I get the chance to speak to, to actors, and they have really connected or really have... You paid attention to the score after watching the film as a, you know, on a whole. I mean, you talking about the score the other night was you know, amazing. And you never really get that often. It's clearly something that you really pay attention to after the
personally,
event.
Personally, I would like to do that as a job. I would genuinely would love to make film music. Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
I've always wanted to. So it's at that place in my life where when I watch a film, a big part of it is listening to the music and whether it works, whether it doesn't, etc. And I love bold music in a film. You know, I really love, you look at the film Jackie with that score, and
yeah,
I just
Mika's amazing.
Yeah,
so good.
And I remember someone saying to me a long time ago, "Well, you just want to not notice it, and you just, you know." And I remember thinking, "No, I want to be smacked in the face with it. I don't." And there's a difference between someone trying to manipulate you with the music and somebody actually going, look at this hand in hand with this moment or this performance. That's very different than someone going, you're meant to feel really sad now.
Totally.
Yeah.
Do it.
You know, listening to this score with this film, it actually makes the film feel bigger, more epic. It's an enormous film anyway, but it gives it even more gravitas.
It's another character,
doesn't it?
Like,
listen, you know, the sound design in the film in general, you know, one of the only contributors in this film that has gone somewhat overlooked is my sound designer. Who is a genius. I mean, the reason that sequence on the ship is what it is, every single breath, every single line of dialogue, competing, you know, diegetic audio and non-diegetic audio, all of that was built because, you know, in reality, there was so much going on that I was playing a demo for all of the background performers to be able to move to, because we hired dancers to be in the background so that there would be a sort of rhythm, a sort of cadence, you know?
Yeah.
And so my mixer, Steve Single, I mean, he had to piece by piece completely rebuild the first 10 minutes of the film, balancing the voiceover and music and sound design, all the stuff. And I think he's one of the most visionary, designers that I've ever worked with. And I've worked with a lot of the best. And I just wanted to take a second to call him out.
Yeah.
He is really on another level, that guy, Steve Single.
Steve Single, we applaud you, sir. Liz, thank you so much for your time. I could genuinely chat to you both for hours about this film and all these brilliant collaborations, but huge congrats.
Well, that was the loveliest interview of the day. So thank you.
Take that, really.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
From the score to the brutalist, that's Bath by Daniel Bloomberg, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Brady Corbett and Guy Pearce. My huge thanks to Brady and Guy for joining us. The Brutalist, as I said, is on general release in the UK as of this coming Friday and is fully deserving of the accolades and awards it is racking up. You can find every single episode of Soundtracking at edithbowman.com with our 500th episode, crikey, fast approaching. How have we managed that? We do have plans to celebrate that with some friends of the show, so watch this space. Follow us on socials. We're at Soundtracking UK and our YouTube channel is called Soundtracking Extra, where there is loads of great video content up there for you to check out. Next up, the wonderful Jason Reitman talking about his film Saturday Night, which is a celebration of the very first episode and how it actually happened of Saturday Night Live. I'm very much looking forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims. Sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Did I put the clothes in the dryer?
I hope they don't think I was serious. I need to be awake.
What's next?
I have my brain shut off.
Just sleep already.
When your racing thoughts keep you up at night, it's tough to let go and get the rest you need. Better sleep can help. You might have heard of white or brown noise, but there's a whole rainbow of color noises, and they can help you calm your mind, reduce stress, and sleep better, like the green noise you're listening to now. With the Better Sleep app, you can discover more color noises and over 200 soothing sounds, guided meditations, and bedtime stories. High-quality rest is vital to your mental well-being and physical health. Calm your restless mind, conquer your day, and sleep better at night. Download Better Sleep from the App Store or Google Play and start a 7-day trial today. Because when you sleep better, you feel better.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.